Good morning. Welcome to another edition of the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you. A bit jet-lagged, but otherwise okay. It's the first time I've ever gotten jet-lagged going from the West Coast East. But it happened. Huh. Must be global warming. That is going to be our subject today. We are going to have Professor Richard Lindzen of Massachusetts Institute of Technologies in the Department of Climatology there. And he wrote, we were going to have him on last week, and he and I just got our signals crossed as to who was going to call whom. But we're very clear, we're going to be calling him today. He's in Paris for the summer, and yet he's going to take time to talk with us about his perspective on global warming. He wrote an op-ed on June 29th in the Wall Street Journal that quickly became the most emailed article in the Wall Street Journal. And the article was called, "There Is No Consensus on Global Warming." Essentially, this is Professor Lindzen's response, public response, to Al Gore's book, An Inconvenient Truth, which has been receiving an awful lot of attention and has been portraying a consensus among scientists that global warming is there. I've heard many things like this. For example, a writer for the New Yorker a month or two ago wrote what I thought was a very credible article on the state of global warming science and portrayed that, in fact, there doesn't seem to be much consensus among, or I'm sorry, that there is, doesn't seem to be much debate any longer between scientists that global warming is a fact. So there are a lot of facts getting thrown around by people, and I wanted to have Professor Lindzen on because of his credentials, and two, because of this very public editorial that he wrote, and we're going to have him on in just a few minutes. In the meantime, newcapitalshow.com is the website for the show. A lot of people have been signing up for the email. The email newsletter, for example, I sent out discussing the fact that Professor Lindzen will be on the show, and I do that each week. So if you would like to be notified of who's going to be on the show, what's going to be the topic, and any articles or any other information that might be presented during the show, newcapitalshow.com, and right on the front page there, you can put in your email address, and you will then receive notifications. There are many other things as well. Forums, article databases, lists of links, and so forth. www.newcapitalshow.com. Telephone here, 713-526-5738. I'm hoping that we'll be able to take your calls today for Professor Lindzen. Again, we were going to have him on last week, but he and I were not able to hook up. We had a very, very good discussion on immigration, and these issues continue to percolate in the American media, how to deal with illegal immigration. I stated my position last week. I said that, in fact, I felt the government had not made nearly enough allowance over the past 2 to 3 decades for legal immigration from Latin America. That the trends of living here in the United States, the trend of immigration within the United States of people from the East and the Midwest to the Southwest parts of the United States could have been predicted, and that that growth of those parts of the country would attract labor from Latin America, and that I felt, I haven't researched this, I haven't actually done the numbers, and I should do the numbers, but I felt, it seemed to me, that the government should have made far more allowances for immigration from Latin America and made far more slots available for legal immigration, and therefore we wouldn't be calling everyone illegal. I know that this is a subject that continues to stir passions, and maybe we'll do a whole show, maybe get an expert guest to give us some testimony about it. A couple of news items, June 29th. Page one. I alluded to this a few weeks ago but didn't get into depth. Energy stocks. Big players join race to put farm waste into your gas tank. One way to wean America from its addiction to foreign oil might well lie in the muddy solution swirling about a glass container on top of a DuPont company laboratory bench. Inside the liter-sized vessel, a desert-loving bacterium is making motor fuel. The organism, which normally lives on the agave plant of tequila fame, is munching on the chopped-up leaves and stalk of a plant and excreting a dilute form of ethanol, the gasoline substitute normally made from corn kernels in the U.S. The tiny organism and others being engineered in competing labs around the country could hold the keys to a new U.S. fuel source, cellulosic ethanol, which can be made from crop residues, wood chips, switchgrass, and even municipal garbage. The effort to make cellulosic ethanol into a full-blown power source to run America's cars is embryonic, and its outcome uncertain. But the fuel has two big things going for it: high oil prices and backing from the Bush administration, which sees it as a potentially important part of future energy supplies and is putting up money to help launch the first biorefineries to make it. Adherents think it could reduce U.S. dependence on imported oil, cut emissions that cause global warming, and shore up the nation's rural economy. Already the race is attracting big names, with the likes of Archer Daniels Midland, Royal Dutch Shell Group, and Goldman Sachs investing time and seed money. In the U.S., ethanol for fuel is typically made from corn, but growing corn gobbles up a lot of power in the form of everything from fertilizer to pesticides. This is Leo Gold talking. This is a huge debate whether corn provides any net benefit in the energy sector, whether corn ethanol provides any net benefit because of the amount of energy it takes to produce. This is because of the difference in the constitution of corn starch-based ethanol versus something like switchgrass, cellulosic ethanol. The economics of cellulosic ethanol made essentially from waste could be different, with the booming economies of China and India helping increase the world's appetite for petroleum faster than new sources of fossil fuel can be found. Economists figure there will be a need for tens of billions of gallons of alternative fuels within just a few decades. Suddenly, there is a race out there to develop a new source of energy, says Thomas Connolly, DuPont's chief innovation officer. Until recently, the idea of squeezing ethanol from farm waste and other sources was barely clinging to life in the recesses of university campuses and federal labs. Few in the private sector seriously pursued the idea for the simple reason that it's far easier to make ethanol from corn. And of course, as we know, there is an enormous built-up infrastructure here in the United States for corn. Corn is used in vast amounts of snack foods. It's used in soda water, corn syrup. Soda water, soft drinks are no longer made in this country, really, in any significant way from cane sugar, but instead made from corn syrup. And so corn is embedded in our economy across vast swaths of the agricultural landscape of this nation. And as a result, the corn lobby is now rearing its head in favor of ethanol. And yet, it appears that corn may not be the best raw material for producing ethanol. It takes a lot of energy to do so, and you don't get as much output. I think the numbers are that, for example, cane ethanol made from sugar cane, actually provides, I think, 7 times as much output per single unit of mass, as does corn, and is one of the major reasons why Brazil has become very much energy self-sufficient in this area. And so we see that high prices are, in fact, having a major effect. High prices for gasoline in this country are having a major effect on consumers and also causing very different investment profile by U.S. companies and by U.S. science. And this is as it should be. If the price of energy is more closely aligned with what it should actually be, when all costs have been added in, all true costs, including costs of pollution, including costs of distribution, raw materials, etc., when all this has been added in, you should get a true price. And that true price is the price that will allow people to make consumption decisions and will allow producers to make accurate supply decisions. Evolution's Lonely Battle in a Georgia Classroom. I alluded to this one very quickly a few weeks ago, too, but I want to take a little more time with it. June 28th, this is from the New York Times. Occasionally, an educational battle will dominate national headlines. More commonly, the battling goes on locally, behind closed doors, handled so discreetly that even a teacher working for a few classrooms away, might not know. This was the case for Pat New, 62 years old, a respected veteran middle school science teacher who, a year ago, quietly stood up for her right to teach evolution in this rural northern Georgia community and prevailed. She would not discuss the conflict while still teaching because Ms. New would not let anything disrupt her classroom, but she decided to retire a year earlier than planned. This evolution thing was a lot of stress, she said. And a few weeks ago, on the very last day of her 29-year career at 315, when Lumpkin County Middle School had emptied for the summer, and she had taken down her longest poster from room D11A, the 15-billion-year timeline ranging from the Big Bang to the evolution of man and woman, I add, Leo Gold adds, she recounted one teacher's discreet battle. She isn't sure how many questioned her teaching of evolution. Perhaps a dozen parents, teachers, and administrators, and several students in her seventh grade life science class. They sent email messages and letters, stopped her in the hall, called board members, demanded meetings, requested copies of the PBS videos that she showed in class. One parent asked how money could be wasted on a subject like evolution. As budget cuts continuously chip away at our children's future of a good, quality college-ready education, she wrote, I would think there would be more educational, more worthwhile, and certainly more factual learning that could be taught, one parent asked. She requested that her son be permitted to bide his time elsewhere when evolution was taught. Ms. New explained that evolution is so central to biology, the boy would be biding elsewhere, his time elsewhere, all year long. Practically every chapter in her Prentice Hall textbooks, Bacteria to Plants, Cells and Heredity, Animals, all of these classes used evolution to trace the development of life starting with bacteria, green algae, and gymnosperms. The books were purchased by her district, and she sent her supervisors copies marking evolution references with dozens of post-its, but it did not seem to register. On April 25, 2005, during a meeting about parent complaints with her principal, Rick Connor, she recalled, he took a Bible off the bookshelf behind him and said, Patty, I believe in everything in this book. Do you? I told him, I really feel uncomfortable about your asking that question. He would not let it go. The next day, she said, in the lunchroom, he reached across the table, took my hand and said, I accept evolution in most things, but if they ever say God wasn't involved, I could not accept that. I want you to say that, Pat. Asked to comment during an interview here, Mr. Connor would only say, I don't want to talk about it. So what did this woman do? What did this woman do who was receiving requests from parents not to teach evolution, and she understood that it was her duty to the children? As a teacher of biology, as a teacher of science, she understood that it was her duty to the children. She said, I thought I was going crazy, said Ms. New, who has won several outstanding teacher awards and is one of only two teachers at her school with national board certification. The other is her husband, Ward. She said, it takes a lot to stand up and be willing to have people angry at you. But she did. She repeatedly urged her supervisors to read Georgia's science standards, particularly S7L5, which calls for teaching evolution. On May 5, 2005, she filled out a complaint to initiate a grievance under state law, writing that she was being, quote, threatened and harassed, though, quote, I am following approved curriculum. She also wrote, if we could get together within 24 hours and settle this, and I feel I have support to teach the standards, then I would tear it up. Suddenly, the superintendent was focused on standards. Mr. Moy called the State Department's middle school science supervisor and asked about evolution. Obviously, the State Department of Education supports evolution, Mr. Moy said in an interview. Obviously, so why call? I wanted to be sure, he said. Let's make sure what these standards are. He added, I feel strongly about the Georgia standards. I think it's very important. obviously will teach standards. That's the law. We will do everything in accordance with the Department of Education. And parents' rights? Mr. Moore, the principal, said, I explained to parents that we're following the state standards. You can believe what you want, but we have to teach the standards. If they're upset, they can take it up to the state level. The superintendent, principal, and Ms. Green all praised Ms. New's ability. The lady is an excellent teacher, Mr. Moy said, adding, maybe she felt like the school system didn't support her. We certainly support her. Ms. New said that from then on, including the entire 2005 to 2006 school year, she had no problem teaching evolution. What saved me, she said, was I did not have to argue evolution with these people. All I had to say was, I'm following state standards. And so it goes, the battle over science. The battle over science proceeds in America's classrooms, where many of our very best teachers, many of our most qualified and outstanding teachers, fight a daily and lonely battle to present the truth as far as we humans have been able to discover it. And I qualify evolution by saying that. As far as we have been able to tell, it is the best that we know of how biology proceeds on this planet. And our students and our children should receive the benefit of being taught the best of our knowledge. The best of our knowledge. And yet so often here in this country, our students get the worst of our knowledge, and parents themselves working on half information, fractional information, try to impose those standards on teachers in our classrooms. Here in Texas, this is a cautionary tale. If you want to get something done, perhaps it bears focusing very much on state teaching standards, arbitrary as that may seem. Any parent interested in education in the public schools, any parent interested in seeing and understanding what is being taught should turn to the state standards. And anyone interested in change in education in this country, and certainly in the state, should also look to those standards. This is a fascinating article of a teacher who waged a very lonely battle in the classroom and who received often very, very overt questioning of her teaching by both parents and administrators and probably other teachers alike, and had to turn to those standards that are in existence. We're going to take a short break here. When we get back, we will be talking about global warming and whether there is or is not a consensus on it. I'm Leo Gold. This is the New Capital Show.
Yeah.
Leo Gold back here on the New Capital Show. Pleasure to have you this morning, as always. We're still trying to get a hold of Richard Lindzen in Paris. Apparently the phones do not work very well between the United States and Paris. We're still trying to figure out that technology. If we get him, fine. If we don't, that'll be fine, too. We will take your calls and talk about global warming and the consensus, 713-526-5738. In the meantime, I will do my best to portray his article to you. Richard Lindzen wrote on June 26, 2006, according to Al Gore's new film, An Inconvenient Truth, we're in for a, quote, planetary emergency, melting ice sheets, huge increases in sea levels, more and stronger hurricanes, and invasions of tropical disease, among other cataclysms. Then he mentions the previous president. Bill Clinton has become the latest evangelist for Mr. Gore's gospel. And all this is Mr. Lindzen's writing. He calls it Mr. Gore's gospel, proclaiming that current weather events show that he and Mr. Gore were right about global warming, and we are all suffering the consequences of President Bush's obtuseness on the matter. And why not? Mr. Gore assures us that the debate in the scientific community is over. Again, Mr. Gore says, quote, the debate in the scientific community is over. Mr. Gore really is saying that. I was at the event here in Houston when Gore appeared, and he basically took the stage and said that very, very few scientists believe any longer that global warming is not occurring as a result of human influence on the climate, specifically human emissions of CO2. There was an article by a New York Times writer, I'd say about a month back, and she portrayed basically the same thing. And in fact, Mr. Gore has gone so far as to say that there are scientists who would like to go further with their statements, but are cowed for one reason or another from being more frank about their opinions. And he says that many big-name scientists are coming to him and giving him actually more information than they are willing to state. And so Lindzen says that statement, which Mr. Gore made in an interview with George Stephanopoulos, presumably to promote the book An Inconvenient Truth, ought to have been followed by an asterisk. What exactly is this debate that Mr. Gore is referring to? Is there a scientific community that is debating all these issues and then somehow agreeing in unison? For such a thing being over, it has never been clear to me, this is Professor Lindzen, what this debate actually is in the first place. He says, so presumably, scientists do not belong to the consensus. It says their research is forced, whether the evidence supports it or not, into Mr. Gore's preferred global warming template. And the template that he says Mr. Gore supports is shrill alarmism. To believe it requires that one ignore truly inconvenient facts. To take the issue of rising sea levels, these include that the Arctic was as warm or warmer in 1940, that icebergs have been known since time immemorial, that the evidence so far suggests that the Greenland ice sheet is actually growing on average. A likely result of all this is increased pressure pushing ice off the coastal perimeter of that country, which is depicted so ominously in Mr. Gore's movie. In the absence of factual context, these images are perhaps dire or alarming. Then Lindzen says they are less so otherwise. Alpine glaciers have been retreating since the early 19th century and were advancing for several centuries before that. Since about 1970, many of the glaciers have stopped retreating and some are now advancing again, and frankly, we do not know why. The other elements of the global warming scare scenario are predicated on similar oversights. Malaria, claimed as a byproduct of warming, was once common in Michigan and Siberia, and remains common in Siberia. Mosquitoes don't require tropical warmth. Let's see. Lindzen goes on to say, a general characteristic of Mr. Gore's approach is to assiduously ignore the fact that the Earth and its climate are dynamic. They are always changing, even without any external forcing. To treat all change as something to fear is bad enough. To do so in order to exploit that fear is much worse. Regardless, these items are clearly not issues over which debate is ended, at least not in terms of the actual science. A clearer claim as to what debate has ended is provided by the environmental journalist Greg Easterbrook. He concludes that the scientific community now agrees that significant warming is occurring and that there is clear evidence of human influences on the climate system. This is still a most peculiar claim. At some level, it has never been widely contested. Most of the climate community has agreed since 1988 that global mean temperatures have increased on the order of 1 degree Fahrenheit over the past century, having risen significantly from about 1919 to 1940, decreased between 1940 and the early 1970s. And anyway, so Lindzen's... Okay, Richard Lindzen will be with us in a second. Professor Lindzen goes on to discuss the fact that there are all these different contradicting pieces of evidence that lead us to conclude that there may not be global warming, and therefore there is no consensus. He says there is little disagreement that levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere have risen from about 280 ppm parts per million by volume in the 19th century to about 387 parts per million. And so that's a pretty key fact. I think we've got Professor Lindzen with us. Professor Dick Lindzen, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Welcome to the New Capital Show. Professor, thank you very much for joining us. I wanted to have you on because your discussion, There Is No Consensus on Global Warming, appeared on June 26th in the Wall Street Journal and quickly became the most emailed. I don't know if you know that. Do you know they have these rankings of emailed articles? And yours was number one at the time. And, of course, I've seen that happen. I'm a reader of the Wall Street Journal. I've seen that whenever an article by a renowned authority basically saying that either global warming is not occurring or that there is no consensus, that it quickly becomes the most emailed article and cited by many, many sources. In fact, I think that your article was cited very quickly by the Senate Commission on the Environment. Specifically by the majority, not by the minority, and that is to say by the Republicans. So let's get into this. You are not saying that global warming is not occurring. You are saying that you take issue with Al Gore's portrayal that there is a consensus in the scientific community.
Well, let me be careful, because the statement, the title was put on by the Wall Street Journal, and it was later changed to "What's the Hype About?" And that's more accurate. Consensus is always suspicious in science. But in connection with Gore's movie and his presentation, he has so many different manifestations and cataclysms that are described that to subsume that all under a consensus seem to me extraordinarily unlikely and misleading. I did mention some things I thought there was widespread agreement on, that the temperature has warmed about a half degree centigrade in the last century, that CO2 has gone up. The increase in temperature has been very irregular. It went up a lot between 1919 and 1940. It went down a bit, went up a bit. You know, actually, for the last 5-6 years, it's been level. And so the question has been, is, one, any of that due to man, any of the temperature increase? And two, and that's a question often left out, is it what the models say we should have seen?
Now, the person who first hypothesized that CO2 would be an absorber of infrared energy, wasn't it a Danish Nobel Prize winning scientist around the turn of
Arrhenius?
Arrhenius, yeah. And I don't know that he
actually
won.
He may not have been the first. Fourier did it early in the century. I mean, the thought has been around.
But that's knowledge that we've had for a century or more. That CO2 would
have... It's been argued. I mean, somebody suggested that was the reason the temperatures went up in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And then British meteorologists pointed out that carbon dioxide was not the main greenhouse gas, but that water vapor and clouds were more important.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that sort of died when the temperature started going down. And you may recall, if you're old enough, that there was a global cooling craze in the 70s.
I do remember it vaguely, but I don't remember it being anywhere near as big as the current global warming craze.
Nowhere near. But you still had Time magazine declaring all scientists agree.
Yeah.
As Newsweek did in 88 on this issue, before most scientists had even thought about it.
You say there's little disagreement that levels of CO2 in the atmosphere have risen from 280 parts per million by volume, PPMV, in the 19th century to about 387. So that's, I don't have my calculator, that looks to be about, I don't know, 33-40%.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which is significant. Now,
terms of greenhouse warming, it isn't that significant.
Why is that? Why do you say that?
Because, first, it's not the major greenhouse gas. A lot of things to consider in this. It's not the main greenhouse gas. If you doubled CO2 and did nothing else, you'd get about 1 degree warming. The other thing about it is, you know, the first pit you put in is more important than the second and the third, because it just doesn't just add up. It's like painting a window black. The first coat does more than the second and the third and so on. And so, on the one hand, doubling CO2 by itself shouldn't do much. On the other hand, we've already had the greenhouse warming potential equivalent, you know, if you add methane and CO2, to about three-quarters of what you get from a doubling. And we're seeing much less than the models say we should have seen. Forecasts are based on models which might be exaggerated.
You say in your article, alluding to that, you say we should see higher, we should theoretically see a higher increase as a result of this increase in CO2. Indeed, if all else were kept equal, the increase in CO2 should have led to somewhat more warming than has been observed.
Yeah.
My question is this. Are there two possibilities there? Either one, global warming does not hold under planetary conditions, or two, these other variables that you frequently allude to in your article here, and probably in many times when you talk about this issue, that those variables are in play as well, and we don't understand that there might be a contravening cooling effect. Is that a possibility?
Oh, sure. And really the question is, what is the countervailing cooling effect? And one argument might be that the climate is well designed and resists change, and there are negative feedbacks that resist the change. And the other conclusion is some unknown process has canceled it. And by and large, people who believe in global warming as a serious threat think some unknown process has canceled it, and it will stop someday, and we'll see that the models were right. It's asking for a lot of special pleading. It's not that it's a self-evident case.
Let me ask you an economics question.
Okay, not that I'm an economics expert, but
let's do, I think they used to call them thought experiments, isn't that right?
Yeah, thought experiments.
Scientists do thought experiments. Professor, you live in Newton, which is a beautiful town in Massachusetts. I assume you have a house.
Yep.
Let's assume that in the backyard of your house you have a machine. And it does nothing except produce CO2.
Okay.
There's no other point to the machine. It just produces CO2. And let's say
a person. We breathe and produce CO2.
Right.
Okay.
And this machine does it, and it does it in, let's say the quantity that it does it in is 2 billion tons a year, which is roughly the amount that is emitted by the coal business in this country, coal utilities. Would you say that the government, standing on and looking at this machine, should either, you know, A, do nothing, B, shut this machine down, or C, attempt to put some license fee for your using it? What would be your reaction as a, you know, as your economic reaction.
how should I put it? That's an easy case.
Well, no. What?
Now, I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because the way you frame it, I'm in the backyard, I'm generating it, it's for no purpose. If I'm generating that much in my backyard, it's going to cause problems. And those problems are much bigger than global warming, so I would favor stopping it.
What do you mean? What are those problems that this machine would be causing?
Well, if you were emitting 2 billion tons of CO2 from my backyard in a year, you'd probably be inundating the atmosphere in that region of CO2 and blocking out the oxygen.
So it would be concentrated in such a small region,
right?
That would be the problem.
Yes.
Otherwise,
if it were uniformly distributed through the U.S. as the current emissions are, I would be hard-pressed to argue why we should do anything at this point, simply because global warming is a global issue. Our emissions would not do a lot to alter it, no matter what you believe. But in addition, shutting down completely, I mean, nobody's talking about that. We're talking about slowing down emissions. That would do next to nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me change the machine up a little bit. Let's say that you one day came up with an addition to the machine, and that addition, the improvement to the machine, allowed you to distribute the CO2 throughout the U.S. equally.
Yeah.
Would you then again say, let's just go through the choices again. A, government standing there looking at you running this machine would do nothing. B, they should tell you to shut it down. Or C, they would develop some license fee under which you would be able to operate it for the remediation, as it were, of the emission of the CO2.
You know, nobody is talking about any of those.
Well, but isn't the case...
I mean, those are not the only choices.
Okay, well, what are the others?
The other choice was, and that's the one that was taken at Kyoto and is taken in the various congressional bills put forward, which would say, hey, you've been running this machine, mm-hmm. and you've been putting out more and more CO2 each year. We want you to stabilize it.
Okay. So you don't see any argument that the government might try to determine what your price of running that machine is, which is to say...
They might indeed ask me how much would it be worth to keep in business for whatever reason I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in a way, that's kind of a highway robbery, because it's saying, then it's not the environment that's at issue. We just want to make sure we get a cut.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't Newton's first law, for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction?
I think that's the third.
Oh, that's the third law. That's why you're the scientist. Newton's third law... For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. What is your personal belief, Professor, that about Newton's third law holding for our emissions of CO2 on the planet?
Well, it certainly is not supposed to apply, but there's a more common thing in engineering. Namely, you build devices to resist change. That is to say, your body has regulation built into it, so your body temperature doesn't change when you're well. When you build a bridge, you build in some device that can swing in the wind and resist breaking. You do all sorts of things like that. It's quite remarkable that our climate model suggests the climate is exactly the opposite of that, that whatever man does with CO2 the natural constituents, water vapor and clouds, will act to make it worse. Now, nobody can prove at this point that that is impossible, but it is a peculiar view of the world.
You describe your science, your field, which is meteorology. I think the word you use in your article is primitive.
It's certainly at a very early stage. I mean, it's a field which is mathematically complex. It's just emerging from what I would call a taxonomic stage, when you try to do everything by just describing what you saw, a front developed here, an air mass there, and so on, and gave it names. It's just, you know, in the early stages of being an analytic science. And climate is, in a way, even further behind, because it's dealing with long-term prediction. And, you know, how shall I put it, to be blunt, in these fields, which are very complicated and very primitive, that isn't where the rocket scientists typically go.
Well, here, my question is this. If the state of this science is primitive, you've called weather and climate science primitive, and yet we have experiments that have come out of physics, such as Arrhenius' experiment.
Well, that's not experimental.
Okay.
I mean, he was wrong on a lot of counts, including the spectrum of carbon dioxide.
And we have biologists out in the field who are taking field readings. Is it possible that your field is kind of leaving some of the critical observations to these other fields, including biology, where scientists are finding drastic effects going on and harmful effects to other species and other regions of the world?
I think the foundation of the subject is the physics, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
We're still not in a position where we can a priori predict the temperature of the Earth to the accuracy that we're talking about. Remember, we're talking about very small changes in temperature. I mean, arguments are running, is it getting warmer, is it getting colder? But in general, in public discourse, nobody ever asks how much. And how much matters all, practically, in science.
I hear frequently that small changes in the climate, even small changes, could have dire effects. That seems to me to be something that is frequently, a case that is frequently made by proponents
true,
of...
Mm-hmm. It has a problem, because the climate is always changing.
Mm-hmm. But
especially when you're talking of tenths of a degree.
But a secular change, a constant, statistically significant changing.
Even that... I mean, you know, in other words, it fluctuates a half degree if you look at the temperature records. And the trend is no bigger than the fluctuations, but it's worse than that. Regionally, any place on Earth, even for North America, continental North America, temperature changes fluctuations have been much larger than they are for the global mean. There are a few places that have gotten cooler over the last century. Wherever that's occurred, people have adapted. So it's really, we have places where temperature has changed, and we can see what happens. There are occurrences, like northern Florida used to be citrus country, now apparently it's not. But it isn't as though it collapsed from that.
My guest today, this is Leo Gold, this is the New Capital Show, and my guest is Professor Richard Lindzen, professor of meteorology at MIT.
Atmospheric science, meteorology.
And we are talking about his op-ed piece that apparently you did not name. But the Wall Street Journal named it, there is no consensus on global warming. How did you come to get this piece into the Wall Street Journal? What do? You just write them and say, I've got a rebuttal to Gore.
I mentioned to them that, you know, I would like to put a piece in, and I thought that the movie was perhaps conveying a rather hysterical impression.
Mm-hmm. You call it shrill?
I also felt that,
you call it shrill alarmism.
Yeah.
I have a...
I think it is. I mean, he's cherry-picking. I mean, you know, if the science says this is grossly unlikely, but maybe so-and-so says it's possible, that becomes the truth, and the inconvenient truth for Gore.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, it sounds convenient, because he has cherry-picked it.
How would you characterize the current state of consensus or lack of consensus in the scientific community? Gore presents his view that there is a consensus. What is your view about the scientific community?
Is the things I mentioned are things that there is fairly widespread agreement on. The problem with that agreement is that agreement does not have any particular alarming implications. And then to say that that agreement also applies to whatever he wishes to say about anything else seems to be slightly misleading.
A listener writes, bottom line, the Earth's temperature must go up with CO2 increase in the absence of equally mitigating factors, like increased clouds. That's true, right?
Yeah. If you have nothing else, it'll go up.
Okay.
But remember, we said numbers are important.
Yeah. He says, but there is a lag time, and no one knows what it is for sure because of the complexity of the system.
Well,
a reasonable guess would be that the time constant for temperature change is a number of decades. If this is the case, most of the CO2 has been added in the last century. Therefore, we are only beginning to see the warming effects. Do we have a lag time issue, do you think?
There is a lag time issue, and that's why I'm citing a model, the UK Met Office model, which the IPCC uses, that has that built in. Most models, I think, have probably excessive delay time, but that's a technical issue. It's because they have what's called too much diffusion in the ocean. But you know, there's little question that we've had enough increase in radiative forcing already decades ago that we should have seen more.
And this goes back to the point we discussed earlier, which is, are there other variables at play here that could be causing a mitigation in the effects of CO2 increases?
Yes. That's part of it, certainly.
Do you feel, Professor, that our society should be investigating this question, and that there may be a large probability that climate here on Earth is at risk as a result of addition of CO2 from human burning?
Personally, I don't think it's a large probability. You know, you rarely will find a scientist who says you shouldn't study it. Obviously, you should. But, I mean, what worries me a little is the science is getting hooked on the alarmism because that's led to such large increases in funding. So you have, if you look carefully, you have a lot of statements that come out of the science that don't say anything very definite, but are vague enough that anyone who wants to misread them can do so. And I don't think that's the healthiest state for a science either.
You say at the end, you take issue with you say, what should we make of the alleged debate? And you say that, basically you're claiming there is no debate. It's an alleged debate. I'm not quite, you'll help us understand that point.
You know, there is the business of, you know, the picture I get, maybe one is trying to infer a different picture, is that there is this debate going on, and some scientists say it's warming and some don't, and so on. That I've never seen that. You have a temperature record. Some people have questions about it. Some feel it's likely to be okay. You have arguments about certain aspects of the problem, so you've had some fairly large arguments as to whether hurricanes are changing intensity. And you have some arguments about attribution. can you attribute anything you've seen so far to man?
Do you attribute the rise in CO2 to man?
Oh, no, that's sure. You know, even though there are arguments about that, I think, you know, most people I know believe that that is the case. It's not such a slam dunk as it's made out.
Is there a point at which CO2 levels would get that would concern you? You said a doubling would not seem to concern you. We're 40% of the way there.
Yeah. How shall I put it? There is a point at which I suppose there could be rather concrete concern. And that is, if the alarming picture is correct, one will certainly see evidence of a clearer sort. What bothers me of late is you have a lot of articles saying, you know, a toad appeared with two heads. This must be due to global warming. And that is just rendering the science silly, and it's not contributing to anything. If the CO2 continues increasing, and one sees a clear trend, then, you know, one will have a far more substantive basis for evaluating how much concern there should be. And even then, there remains an additional problem of what can we do about it.
So in a way, we're kind of waiting, in your perspective, for your position on Newton's third law as it appears in the rise in CO2, or what the implications for the third law would be in for a rise in CO2 from your perspective. Does that make sense?
Well, I wouldn't use third law because that refers to something else.
Okay.
But I know what you mean in general.
What the consequences are. We're waiting for a description in your model of what consequences would look like.
I would like to see, and, you know, here too, there are claims which I do disagree with. What you want to see is something that very clearly goes outside the range of normal fluctuations. And while there have been claims, you know, about unprecedented change and so on, one just has to look at the temperature record to see that it fluctuates at the present level and can do so without any forcing. That's something people have a lot of trouble with, but it happens to be true that the system we call climate does not need solar fluctuations. It does not need CO2 to wobble.
Professor, why would we not, as humans, and if we are emitting such large amounts of CO2 and we're seeing that rise, why would we not want to establish a fee? Why would we not want to establish a license fee for putting that amount of CO2 into our common air?
That's a political decision.
Uh-huh.
I mean, CO2...
Well, you have a political sense, I'm sure.
All I'm saying is CO2 is not a normal pollutant.
Why not?
It's a product of breathing.
Yes,
would
it is.
Would you want a tax on breathing?
Well, breathing, no, but wouldn't we want to look at other processes where CO2 is not so naturally tied, such as burning excessive amounts of fuel?
Well, you know, then you're back to the other thing. You're saying burning excessive amounts.
Mm-hmm.
So let's cut it back to non-excessive amounts. At that point, you can usually show that you will do nothing about climate. So you better have another reason for doing it. If you have another reason, argue that reason.
Why do you say we would do nothing about climate?
Because, as I mentioned, if you simply say there's a level of excessive emissions.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not saying get rid of emissions, right?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that we need to think about pricing that level of emissions into the cost structure.
Yeah, how would
of
you
its
know
use?
The damage function?
Well, That's the question that you're arguing. I'm sure that there are many scientists who would be able to come up with some damage function as well to put a price on it. But you're saying we simply don't know what the effects are in order to put a price on it. We do have carbon emissions.
Benefits from the burning of CO2. How do you determine the excessive?
Well, we do have carbon emissions that are trading right now. I think they've tripled in value,
yeah.
If that gives us any notion
of it. Is that true? I thought they collapsed.
That's not what I understand. I think they've tripled in value.
That's an interesting statement. They certainly had collapsed as of a month ago,
uh-huh.
from starting at $40 a ton or something like that, down to $8.
I haven't followed the course of them in the past month, so if you're telling us there's been a collapse...
Well, I was curious about that myself because, that's an interesting thing. When it collapses to $8, somebody could gobble them all up and become an oligarch.
Yep. Professor Lindzen, we've only got about a minute left.
Okay.
You've said that non-scientists are not listening to science and not paying attention to science, and that the media is not helping. Here in an effort today, this is the media,
yeah.
and we're talking to non-scientists. We're trying to make an effort to hear another side of the debate than what is often heard on this particular radio outlet. You used to listen to Pacifica, you told me. What would you like to close with?
Like Pacifica,
how would you like us to think about the global warming issue in a sober way that you think is becoming of scientific inquiry?
Well,
real quick, we've got about
60
seconds.
Okay. I would certainly see what claim pertains to which alarm. And not mix up everything. One of the problems is the incoherence of the discussion. And
on both sides, right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I want to thank you very much. No, it's not. I want to thank you very much for appearing. The big the big news in France is the headbutt, right?
yes, there is considerable concern over what that meant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
This is Leo Gold. This has been another edition of the New Capital Show. That was Professor Richard Lindzen, professor of meteorology at MIT. NewCapitalShow.com. I'll be back with you a week hence. Take care.
I'm Lawrence Lessig from Stanford Law School, and I wanted to tell you about an issue called network neutrality. Network neutrality has been the golden rule of the Internet. It basically means that similar data bits traveling over the network should be treated similarly. But soon this principle may change. Broadband providers have demanded the freedom to begin to accept payments to prefer some people's content over other people's content, begin to build fast lanes on the Internet, meaning everything that doesn't pay shifts to the slow lane. And the principle of their desire is that they have the right to pick and choose the innovations and content that happens on the Internet. So this isn't about paying